There's a powerful story told in multiple threads starting in Genesis chapter 37. It's the beginning of a storyline about Joseph, the son of Jacob. It's a story thread about a boy who dreamt dreams. It's a story thread about jealousy. It's a story about hardship and being tested and tempered. It's a story about humility and leadership. A story about hope and forgiveness. And it's a story about a young man who would become a prince among his people and whose influence would reach far and set the stage for the birth of a nation whose king would be God himself. Please join me in Genesis chapter 37 and verse 2, as we delve into a specific aspect today of this story. Now, by way of introduction, Genesis 37 begins with Jacob living in Canaan, following in the footsteps of his grandfather Abraham, when God called Abraham out of Mesopotamia to come into this strange land of Canaan. And then we see verse 2, we pick up right here, Genesis 37, verse 2. It says, "This is the story of Jacob." But in reality, this narrative begins with the story thread of Jacob's 11th born son, Joseph. Really, the story is about Joseph. Verse 2. Joseph, being 17 years old, was feeding the flock with his brothers. And the lad was with the sons of Bilhah and the sons of Zilpah, his father's wives. And Joseph brought a bad report back to his father. Just a little aside, Leah and Rachel were considered Jacob's primary wives. Then their handmaids, Zilpah and Bilhah, were added as secondary wives to bear more sons to Jacob. We're in verse 3. Let's read verse 3. Now Israel, or Jacob, loved Joseph more than all his children, because he was the son of his old age. And so he made him a tunic of many colors. But when his brothers saw that his father loved him more than all the other brothers, they hated him and could not speak peaceably to him. Sadly, there was favoritism in the family. This is just one of a number of issues that would arise. But Joseph was Jacob's favorite child through Rachel. This became very obvious growing up to the other brothers and sisters. Now, commentators think that this many-colored tunic was actually a very royal decorated garment that a prince or a princess might also wear, something very regal looking. Sibling rivalries were going to already be seen in this family line. Then came the two dreams that Joseph would have, and then Joseph's problems were only beginning. Verse 5, let's continue. Now Joseph had a dream. He told it to his brothers. They hated him even more. So he said to them, "Please hear this dream I've dreamed. Here we were, binding the sheaves in the field, and behold, my sheaf arose and also stood upright, and indeed your sheaves all stood around and bowed down to my sheaf." Well, the brothers figured it out very quickly. They could understand the meaning of the dream. It says, verse 8, "And his brother said to him, 'Shall you indeed reign over us? Or shall you indeed have dominion over us?' So they hated him even more for his dreams, for his words." Verse 9, he dreamed another dream and told his brothers and said, "Look, I've dreamed another dream. This time the sun, moon, and 11 stars bowed down to me," similar to the first dream. Now he tells it to his brothers and father. Verse 10, his father rebukes him and says, "What is this dream you've dreamed? Shall your mother and I and your brothers come to bow down to the earth before you?" And his brothers envied him, and his father kept the matter in mind. So they despised him for his dreams. They despised him for the favoritism Father Jacob showed him. And there was contention and sibling rivalry. Consider this. There are 11 sons now, Joseph being the youngest. Benjamin's not born yet. They come from four different mothers. And yet they're all, 10 of them are out in the field, shepherding in the field at this point. And we see the story growing here. We see that in verse 18, Jacob sends young Joseph at age 17 out to check up on his brothers in Dothan. It's about 50 miles from home. Joseph's brothers see him coming at a distance, and they're despising him. Verse 18, when they see him far off, even though he came near them, they conspired against him to kill him. Then they said to one another, "Look, the dreamer is coming." In the Hebrew language, literally it means, "Here comes the expert of dreams." There's some deep sarcasm there, not just a little bit. Here comes the expert of dreams. He's going to tell us who's going to bow down and serve him. Verse 20, "Come, therefore, let us now kill him and cast him into some pit, and we shall say some wild beast has devoured him. We shall see what will become of his dreams then." So already the brothers are scheming for a way to prevent this dream from coming to pass. We're not told all the little details about how they figured it out. How long did it take them to figure it out? Who was behind these dreams? We're not told all those details yet, but it comes out little by little in the narrative. We also know that Levi and Simeon have a penchant for hostility and being aggressive and violent. And so who knows if they were instigators of this plan? We're not sure. We do know that Reuben leaves the group, goes off and does something, and the rest of them scheme to throw him in a pit. They wait for some Ishmaelite slave traders to come along. They sell him for 20 coins of silver, and he's begging. Later in the story, Joseph is terrified, it says, and he's begging to get out of the pit. They don't want any part of this. They want to get him away from home, away from their lives. He's gone. He's gone now. There are major lessons just to be learned about leadership, about family unity, about parenting in just these initial paragraphs of chapter 37. I tried to summarize some of it. We can see a family pattern that's developed from Abraham, continuing through Isaac, through Jacob, and then the other brothers, the 10 brothers. We can see lies. We can see generation to generation things like deceit, jealousies, and favoritism being passed on. Think about these few things that happened earlier on in the book of Genesis. Twice, Abraham uses deceit, pretending that Sarai is his sister and not his wife, because he feared for his life, but unnecessarily. God was protecting Abraham and Sarah. Life would now get more complicated for Abraham. Sarah, she doubts God's promise for a natural-born son, persuades Abraham to have a son by her Egyptian handmaid, Hagar, and so Ishmael is born. Family relations are now getting much more muddy and complicated. In the next generation, Isaac repeats the same deception that Abraham did, claiming that his wife, Rebekah, was his sister to the Philistine king. More complications. In the next generation, Isaac favors Jacob. Rebekah favors Esau. Rebekah and Jacob resort to trickery to steal Esau's birthright. More complications. Next generation, the 10 sons of Jacob from four different mothers. Again, I mentioned there's rivalry between two wives and secondary wives. There's contention in the family, and it rubs off on the children. Jacob shows favoritism toward Joseph, incites the older brothers to scheme to have Joseph killed. So he's banished. He's not killed, but he's banished to Egypt. Life is starting to get very complicated for Joseph now. We see the pattern repeating and repeating. And now there's an axiom to this so far. It is said, generally in life, with exceptions, of course, righteousness simplifies life, sin complicates life. Again, righteousness simplifies life, sin complicates life. Our mentor, Mr. Richard Thompson, that was one of his many axiomatic statements that we remember from him over the years. And here we see this coming true in this narrative, building up over four generations. Now, for the rest of my message today, in this eloquent story about some remarkable character traits of this young Joseph, in the midst of these wrong and bad examples, how he has this stunning rise to power and authority and influence. And today's message is really about preparation for leadership. The title today, Joseph's Test, comma, Joseph's Triumph. Joseph's Test, Joseph's Triumph. Let's go back now for a moment to Genesis 15 and verse 3. In Genesis 15 and verse 3, we can go back a ways to see what led to Joseph's rise in influence and authority in Egypt. Now, while you're turning there, Romans 15 verse 4 is something to keep in mind when we read these stories. Stories of virtues in the Old Testament, stories of problems, stories of really bad human behavior at times, but stories of victory and stories of faith. Romans 15, verse 4, Paul says this, "For whatever things were written before were written for our learning, that we, through the patience and comfort of the Scriptures, might have hope." These stories were written for our learning. Now, Genesis 15, verse 13, we can see here that Joseph's rise to influence actually starts about 200 years earlier. Remember that Abraham is required by God to come up to Canaan and become strangers in a strange land for a while. The land was not theirs, but that they would multiply greatly, and for a time they would be made slaves and be subjected to bondage. They would suddenly walk out with great riches and great honor after a period of time. Genesis 15, verse 13, God speaks to Abraham, "Know certainly that your descendants will be strangers in a land that's not theirs, and will serve them, and they will be afflicted for 400 years. And also the nation whom they serve I'll judge. Afterward they'll come out with great possessions. Now as for you, you shall go to your fathers in peace, that he should go to his grave at a great old age." Verse 16, "But in the fourth generation they shall return here, for the iniquity of the Amorites is not yet complete." Interesting, God works on different levels. He's watching the Canaanites, their wickedness in the land of Canaan over a 400-year period. At the same time, the Israelites are in Egypt, growing in numbers, and they fall out of favor because a different Pharaoh is now in charge by the time that Moses is called out to be a leader to bring Israel out of Egypt with a high hand. But you see God working these things over a 400-year period. And he's waiting to see if the Amorites are going to change their ways. He says, the wickedness or the iniquity of the Amorites is not yet complete. Very interesting to add that to the narrative when it's really not so much a direct part of Joseph's and Jacob's lives, except for the fact that they're going to inherit the land of Canaan when God drives the wicked nations out. So Genesis 37 gives us a glimpse of how God brings his prophecies to pass. He takes existing situations and he does workarounds to his purposes. We see human frailties here. We see Jacob's favoritism, family jealousies, Joseph's dreams just compound matters for Joseph. And we also see God working in their lives just like he works in yours and my life. He gives us a lot of latitude to make decisions, but if he's working with us and his Holy Spirit is with us or in us, He is steering us through life's challenges, and he wants to see us be successful. But he also sees when human beings make decisions, some good, some not so good. And he can work through those, as we see in this whole narrative in the book of, or the story in the life of Joseph. We can see God working through these things. In Jacob's life, toward the end of his life, I won't turn there, but at the very end, he talks about when he comes down to Egypt as a great old man, and that he's able to stay in Goshen when Joseph is in second in command under Pharaoh. He said he has suffered many things, and he has had to learn through the school of hard knocks some of life's lessons. Jacob says something to that effect at the end of the story, but we won't go there today. All right, so Joseph lands in Potiphar's house. Let's move back to Genesis chapter 39, verse 1. Genesis 39, verse 1. The real focus now is what happens to Joseph to prepare him for his destiny of 80 years, or it appears to be 80 years of leadership in Egypt. At age 17, I'm not reading yet, but just background. Age 17, one day Joseph is loved and doted on by his parents. The next day, he is taken as a slave by a band of slave trading Ishmaelites down into Egypt. God is overseeing this horrible experience. The narrative doesn't give us any indication that Joseph would ever see his mother Rachel again, nor his home that he grew up in his lifetime. We're not shown that. And yet God would steer him and bless him through these hardships. This defies natural human reasoning many times. And this is why God had these kinds of things recorded for us. Because when you and I go through difficulties and trials in life, and everything looks dark, and it looks like God is not listening, and God's somewhere remote, and his attention is elsewhere, or God is silent because we don't always know why. But God is always watching. If he's working with us in our lives, he is steering, he's guiding, he's watching with great compassion and loving kindness. When patience and waiting on God is all we have sometimes in our personal trials, we must recall the great promise which weaves through this story of Joseph. It's Romans 8, verse 28. It's so well known, I won't turn to it. Romans 8, verse 28. And we know that all things work together for good for those who love God and who are called according to his purpose. It's a powerful statement. The Apostle Paul shares that with us. We know that all things work together for good for those who are called, those who love God and who are called according to his purpose. Okay, what about some of another aspect of background of Joseph's life here? We see the parental partiality going on. We see some things influencing young Joseph's character. Now, we're not going to really come down hard on Joseph. He's only 17, okay? He's a teenager when all these things happen to him. He's 17. He's going to learn some things in rapid succession, though, to help mature him when he gets down to Egypt. Joseph had to learn some things in a few days, which might have taken years at home to learn. We don't know, but again, he's going to go through the school of hard knocks just like his father Jacob did. Genesis 39, verse 1. Now Joseph had been taken down to Egypt, and Potiphar, an officer of Pharaoh, captain of the guard, an Egyptian, bought him from the Ishmaelites who had taken him down there. Verse 2. The Lord Eternal was with Joseph, and he was a successful man, and he was in the house of his master, the Egyptian. Now, it's easy to miss this if we read it too quickly. God is allowing Joseph to be sold to a very prominent official under Pharaoh. He is Pharaoh's captain of the royal guard of the royal palace. We could assume that this Potiphar is connected to high levels of power and politics and wealth in Egypt himself, being the captain of the royal guard. Joseph is probably now going to come in contact with some people of rank and influence himself. And it's going to help prepare him for his rulership role in Egypt. Now, here's another illustration. Joseph must now make the commitment. Remember, he's 17. He's completely separated from his own people, from his family, from his community of worship. He must hold fast to that which he was given and taught in his childhood. His childhood training in God's laws and statutes must continue in Joseph in this pagan land where everywhere you turn there are palaces and shrines to false gods. He must stay true, just the same as young Daniel would have when Daniel was taken in the Babylonian captivity and that he had to serve under Nebuchadnezzar and he had to study the ways and the magicians and the Chaldeans and the sciences and the history and the culture of Babylon. And we remember the young Jewish girl, Esther, whose family was also taken to Babylon in captivity. How she was taken from her uncle Mordecai to the king's palace, Ahasuerus or Xerxes, depending on your translation. And she was prepared for months to parade before the king, along with a bunch of other young ladies who are very attractive, very pretty. And you remember Vashti was the former queen that King Xerxes put away, and then he's looking and he's going through this parade of beautiful young women to see which one he might choose for his next queen. And this young Jewish girl is chosen. She must hold fast to her training too as a young girl. We don't know her age, but she's young. She would need to lean on her spiritual upbringing in a totally pagan steeped culture. Now we go back, Genesis 39, verse 3. And his master, Potiphar, saw that the Lord was with him and that the Lord made all that he did prosper in his hand. So Joseph found favor in his sight and served him, and then he made him overseer of his house, and all that he had he put under his authority. That's building trust. Did that happen overnight? Not likely. Not likely at all. Joseph was being watched for his integrity, his trustworthiness, his faithfulness in small things. And we could see Potiphar giving him more and more responsibility to the point where it says Potiphar didn't know anything about his household because he put it all under Joseph's care. All the other servants of the household, only his wife was not under Joseph's care. Of course, that's a very important hint as to what happens next. I would like us to hold our place in Genesis 39 for a moment. Please join me in Proverbs 8, verse 13. Proverbs 8, verse 13. I'd like to read with you just three short passages on some of the same principles that would have applied to Joseph in his grooming for leadership, in his preparation for leadership. I just chose these three Proverbs. Proverbs 8 and verse 14, actually. Verse 14. The fear of the Lord eternal is to hate evil. Pride and arrogance and the evil way and the perverse mouth I hate. Here, wisdom is personified. Counsel is mine, says wisdom, and sound wisdom. I am understanding. I have strength. By me, kings reign and rulers decree justice. By me, princes rule and nobles rule. All the judges of the earth rule by me, wisdom. Wisdom speaking here, personified. Let's skip over to Proverbs 9 and verse 10. Proverbs 9 and verse 10. The fear of the Lord eternal is the beginning of wisdom, and the knowledge of the Holy One is understanding. For by me your days will be multiplied, and years of life will be added to you. Then Proverbs 15, verse 33. Proverbs 15, verse 33. Pretty much the same as Proverbs 9. The fear of the Lord eternal is the instruction of wisdom, and before honor is humility. God's standard never changes. And if that's the case, then we can derive that Joseph was learning some humility. He might have been in his naivete as a 17-year-old back at home with all of his brothers older than him. But here we see his rise to influence in Potiphar's house. There had to be some humility here. So in this foreign environment, Joseph had to preserve everything he was taught growing up in his allegiance to God, and his talents would come to serve him, and God was blessing him through this. But now let's go back. We're going to keep a place in Proverbs. Let's go back to Genesis 39, verse 5. I apologize, I didn't have you put a marker in there. We're going to keep coming back to Genesis 39 a couple more times. Genesis 39, verse 5. So it was from the time that he, Potiphar, made him overseer of his house and all that he had, that the Lord blessed the Egyptian's house for Joseph's sake. And the blessing of the Lord was on all that he had in the house and in the field. Thus he left all that he had in Joseph's hand, and he did not know what he had except for the bread which he ate. That's implicit trust. It's complete trust in Joseph to manage the affairs of his household. Now, even under the humiliation of being a house servant, a slave, but he becomes a house servant, and he's given authority in the household, these experiences were working in Joseph's favor. Joseph, as the start, doesn't show early on, even though the narrative is very short, doesn't show that he has any skills in being diplomatic or discreet with people. He's learning these things, though. Young Joseph obviously lacked experience, wisdom, and humility until he gets into these situations that are grooming him. And with the passage of time and applying godly principles, he's learning these skills. John Maxwell, author of the book titled The 21 Irrefutable Laws of Leadership. It's one of my favorite books on my bookshelf at home. He speaks of one of his so-called laws of leadership called the law of process. It means leadership develops daily, not in a day. John Maxwell says this, I quote in his book, "Becoming a leader is a lot like investing in the stock market. If you hope to make a fortune in a day, you're doomed. It's what you do day by day over the long haul that matters most." And so he's saying leadership develops over time. And certainly we know that Joseph had certain wonderful natural gifts, and we also know that God is blessing him all along the way. But John Maxwell's research points out that nearly all skills of leadership can be learned and improved upon, but that the process doesn't happen overnight. Joseph is developing integrity, diligence, again, humility over this period of time. Let's now go back, holding our place in Genesis 39. Let's go back to Proverbs again, please. This time, Proverbs 22 and verse 29. Proverbs 22, verse 29. It simply says, Proverbs 22, verse 29, "Do you see a man who excels in his work? He will stand before kings. He will not stand before unknown or common or obscure men," depending on your translation again. It's a powerful statement. It's axiomatic. It's one of God's laws of life. See a person who's diligent in his duties, his responsibilities, and he's going to stand before people of prominence and of influence. Just a little aside, I was privileged to be down in Dallas, Texas a few years ago working on a project at the headquarters office, a media project, a summer camp video, and I had an opportunity to go over to Mr. and Mrs. Doug and Tanya Horchek's house for dinner one night. And a few other fellows and ladies were there as well. But walking into his, I guess it was a foyer from the front door, there's a photograph on his wall of President Bush the Younger. President Bush the Younger with Mr. and Mrs. Horchek and their son. And I'm thinking, wow. I stopped and I gazed at that, and he came around the corner, Mr. Horchek did, and I said, that is really a really neat picture. And immediately I just thought of this. I'm not trying to elevate anybody else. Certainly they're not in my hearing, but to have a photograph with the President of the United States, that's a pretty cool thing to put on your own wall with your own family. I thought it was. And so I was thinking, a man who's diligent in his ways will walk among kings, quote unquote, people of influence, and not among just obscure common people. And so that just struck me at that time. This has been something I've seen in various jobs in electronics and engineering going through before being hired in the church. I've seen it in church leadership. I've seen it in corporate settings. People that are diligent rise to higher levels of influence. Let's go on to Proverbs 10, verse 4. Proverbs 10, verse 4. A similar statement about leadership. He who has a slack hand becomes poor. Someone who's not diligent but lazy will become poor. But the hand of the diligent makes rich. He who gathers in summer is a wise son. He who sleeps in a time of harvest is a son who causes shame. Again, it goes back to showing how the diligent will come to positions of influence. Proverbs 12, verse 24. Proverbs 12, verse 24, the hand of the diligent shall rule, but the lazy man will be put to forced labor. You see two contrasts in life. People that are diligent versus people who are not diligent. Luke 16, verse 10. Luke 16, verse 10. This is the end of the parable of the unjust steward. Jesus is talking about what the parable means. Luke 16, verse 10. He who is faithful in what is least is faithful also in much. And he who is unjust in what is least is also unjust in much. Therefore, if you have not been faithful in the unrighteous mammon, in other words, handling of finances, who will commit to your trust the true riches, meaning the eternal riches? Verse 12, and if you have not been faithful in what is another man's, if you're put in custodianship and stewardship of something that belongs to someone else, who will give you what is your own? These speak to leadership. These speak to leadership. Now, you might stop and say, well, Joseph was being blessed because God had a specific direction and was guiding him on a path to a certain end point. And this is true. That much is true. But you also see Joseph exercising good use of time and energy and resources in his care over little details in Potiphar's house. You see small details, and you see it gaining him more and more privilege and more authority within this household. He's being blessed by God, but Joseph attributes that success back to God's favor. And Potiphar can see some extraordinary things happening in his life, how in Joseph's persona and his activities, and it's blessing Potiphar in his house and his field, we saw earlier. Now comes Joseph's greater test. The next great challenge was withstanding the sexual temptations of Potiphar's wife. If the estimate that some scholars have that Joseph probably worked in Potiphar's household for about 10 years... This, again, is an estimate. I don't know. Commentators try to put together the narrative and say, well, it might have been 10 years that he was under Potiphar's household. If that's true, then Joseph is in his physical prime. He's 27 years old. He's good looking and strong. And after years of being entrusted with greater and greater responsibility as the chief steward of Potiphar's house, suddenly he's being chased by Potiphar's wife. It says from day to day. It's not a one-off kind of event. This is day to day. Let's go back to Genesis 39, verse 6. Genesis 39, verse 6, we pick up this narrative. Now Joseph was handsome in form and appearance. And it came to pass after these things, his master's wife cast longing eyes on Joseph. And she said, "Lie with me." I'll be dramatic here. "Lie with me." Day after day. Day after day he's puts up with this. He tries to get out of her view, out of her sight. He doesn't want to be alone with her. He wants to make sure other male members of the household are there in the midst if he's in the house. Verse 8, but he refuses and says to his master's wife, "Look, my master does not know what is with me in the house. He has committed all that he has into my hand. There's no one greater in this house than I, nor has he kept anything back from me but you, Mrs. Potiphar, as you're his wife. How then can I do this great wickedness and sin against God?" Another very important statement. He knows this is a sin against God, not just Potiphar, a sin against God. And so he addresses this with Potiphar's wife. Verse 10. So it was, she spoke to Joseph day by day, that he did not heed her, nor lie with her, nor to be with her. Verse 11. Then comes the accusation. But it happened about this time when Joseph went into the house to do his work. None of the other men of the house was inside. Caught him off guard. That she caught him by his garment, saying, "Lie with me." But he left his garment in her hand. He fled, ran outside. Smart, best thing to do. Flee temptation. Get out of the house. Yes, it doesn't go well at first. But remember the axiomatic statement. All things work together for good for those who love God and who are called according to his purpose. We know the end of the story already. We know it. So verse 14, she calls out to the men in her house and spoke to them, saying, "See, he has brought into us a Hebrew to mock us. He came in to lie with me. I cried out with a loud voice. And then it happened when he heard that I lifted my voice and cried out, that he left his garment with me and fled and went outside." Huge lie to save her sinking pride. Verse 16. So she kept his garment with her until his master came home. Then she spoke to him, Potiphar, with these words like this, saying, "This Hebrew servant you brought to us came in to mock me. So what happened is I lifted my voice, cried out, that he left his garment with me and fled outside." Verse 19. So when his master heard these words, which his wife spoke, saying, "Your servant did to me after this manner," that his anger was aroused. Verse 20, then Joseph's master took him, put him into the royal prison, a place where the king's prisoners were confined. And there he was in the prison. Now, a little analysis from some commentators, and I happen to agree, even though we don't know. Do we think for a minute that Potiphar only believed his wife? Or was there some mental turmoil that he saw possibly the innocence of Joseph, but that he is a man of stature and rank? And perhaps, I'm just possibilities here, he puts Joseph in prison to save the family name. We don't know. But it has to grieve Potiphar after what could have been 10 years of faithful, loyal, diligent service in the household, to have this suddenly happen. I would guess that Joseph tried to make a claim that this was not true, that this was false, and this was not, you know, he was being falsely accused. He still finds himself in prison. So these are just possibilities. Someday we will be able to ask those questions and find out. God was still going to be glorified by Joseph's faithfulness. And this is a lesson for us today. It was God's purpose that the purity and uprightness of God's true believers, including Joseph, was on display. Things would turn around in Joseph's favor. But God's true believers are to stand in clear contrast to the heathen ways of this world. We're to stand out in this world. This is why we're a light that's to be set on a hill and not covered with a basket, letting our light shine so that men will see our good works and glorify their God in heaven. Very important point here. This is what Joseph left us as a legacy. This is what he did. This is what Daniel did. This is what Esther did in their young age. Joseph's faith and integrity were now under attack in a fiery trial. A sudden temptation. I don't know. It doesn't say that he was tempted by her, but he certainly was pressured by Potiphar's wife. So persistent, so strong, how should it be met? He knew the consequences of the choice. On the one hand, he could succumb to Potiphar's wife, try to keep it a secret, the secret liaison, and Potiphar is away from home. It just might be something that would be just entertainment. Keep the matter concealed, perhaps earning her favor. On the other hand, Joseph might be exposed for a sin that was real and bona fide, then go to prison and perhaps be executed for it. Joseph's decision reveals growing moral integrity in him, and he's tested in it. And this is an investment that he makes over years to get to this point. From the narrative, we see that Joseph did not budge one bit. He would not betray the confidence of his master, nor would he sin against the eternal God. Here's something here that we could share with our children as they're growing up. And the younger they are, the more this will have meaning in their young age. We don't want to make our children paranoid, but we can be teaching them that God is watching clearly everything that happens on this earth. In the darkest of night, in the most secret places, God sees as if it were daylight, he says. And he sees our thoughts, he knows our motives, he knows our activities with very watchful eyes. We can tell our children that God is watching every act and every motive, and that he wants to steer us in the ways that bring happiness and joy into our lives and success. Yes, Joseph suffered for his integrity for a season. But Joseph stood firm. Back to John C. Maxwell in a different book, Developing the Leader Within You, another one on my bookshelf, Developing the Leader Within You. It says in chapter 3, the most important ingredient in leadership is integrity. Integrity, honesty, forthrightness, truth, faithfulness, loyalty. Integrity. Here's a quote from John Maxwell's book. We're all faced with conflicting desires. No one, no matter how quote-unquote spiritual, can avoid this battle. Integrity is the factor that determines which one will prevail in life. We struggle daily with situations that demand decisions between what we want to do and what we ought to do, and integrity establishes the ground rules for resolving those tensions. I want to do this, but I know I have to do this. I'd really like to do this, but I should be doing this. It determines who we are and how we will respond before conflict ever appears. What John Maxwell is saying, this is preparation a day at a time for preparing for conflict. And this is exactly what happened to Joseph. We see that he was prepared for it. He was prepared for such a conflict, even though it caught him out of the blue. So it suggests that if Potiphar really believed his wife's charge against Joseph, again, he might have had Joseph executed. Potiphar might have tried to save the reputation of his household, and so he would put him in prison. At first, it says in Psalm 105, verse 18, I won't turn, but a little reference to Joseph when he is first put in prison. He's mistreated by the jailers, roughly treated at first. The psalmist in Psalm 105, verse 18 says, they hurt his feet with fetters. He was laid in irons until the time that his word came to pass. The word of the Lord tested him. God was still testing Joseph. Now, if commentators are accurate or anywhere close to accurate that he might have served in a very important role in Potiphar's household for 10 years, there are three more years left that he could have been in prison. Could have been in prison for 3 years. Holding our place in Genesis 39, once again, please join me in Philippians 1, verse 27. Philippians 1 and verse 27. Philippians 1 and verse 27, this passage, we read in the light of Joseph's patient endurance while he's innocent under the accusation brought against him. Verse 27, this is written for you and me. Only let your conduct be worthy of the gospel of Christ, so that whether I come and see you or I am absent, I may hear of your affairs, that you stand fast in one spirit, with one mind, striving together for the faith of the gospel, and not in any way terrified by your adversaries, which is to them a proof of perdition, in other words, their destruction. But to you, it's proof of your salvation, and that from God. For to you it's been granted on behalf of Christ, not only to believe in him, but also to suffer for his sake, having the same conflict which you saw in me and here is now in me. Skipping down to verse 14. Verses 14 through 16. Do all things without complaining or disputing. This is tough. This is not an easy one. Do all things without complaining and disputing. Verse 15. That you may become blameless and harmless children of God without fault in the midst of a crooked and perverse generation, among whom you shine as lights in the world, holding fast the word of life, that I may rejoice in the day of Christ, that I have not run in vain or labored in vain. The Apostle Paul, like all the servants of God, want to see the fruits of their labors that they may not have seen in their lifetime. Paul, before he draws his last breath, in his letters he talks about wanting to see the success of those who he's taught and trained and labored for. And we would all want that. Now back to Genesis 39, verse 20, a very quick narrative of Joseph's time in prison. Very quickly through this part. Genesis 39, verse 20, Joseph is thrown into prison for a deed that he was unjustly accused of. Again, it could have been 3 years in prison. This is still part of sifting and training and refining Joseph for what is to come. Verse 20, Genesis 39, verse 20, Joseph's master put him in prison, a place where the king's prisoners are confined. He's there in the prison. Verse 21, but the Lord was with Joseph and showed him mercy and gave him favor in the sight of the keeper of the prison. And the keeper of the prison committed to Joseph's hand all the prisoners who were in the prison. Whatever they did there, it was his doing. Same pattern. The pattern hadn't changed from his example, his diligence, his resourcefulness, his industriousness in Potiphar's house. He takes those same skill sets and qualities into a prison. It says the keeper of the prison did not look into anything that was under Joseph's authority because the Lord was with him, and whatever he did, the Lord made it prosper. Now, in this time of prison, Joseph could have witnessed other inmates come and go. It was Pharaoh's royal prison. He could have seen other public officials. He could have seen other people of all different ranks come in and out of that jail. He could have seen the effects of oppression and injustice. He could have seen unjust decisions made on other people's cases. We're not told. It's possible. He could have learned lessons of justice and sympathy and mercy while those years he spent in prison. These experiences would further temper Joseph in his role, preparing him for honor and influence and responsibility as chief governor coming up very soon. And so you see him doing things that are serving others in the prison. Let's go to Genesis 40, verse 1. Genesis 40, verse 1. It came to pass after these things that the butler and the baker, the king of Egypt, offended their lord, the king of Egypt, the Pharaoh. Pharaoh was angry with his two officers, the chief butler or cupbearer and the chief baker. He puts them in the custody of the house of the captain of the guard. Who is that? Potiphar. The place where Joseph was confined. And the captain of the guard charged Joseph with them, and he, Joseph, served them. So they were in custody for a while. It's one small sentence, but it shows something of the character and the continued resourcefulness of Joseph serving the officials that were jailed for some offense. Verse 8. Now let's summarize very quickly. We learn that both the butler and the baker had powerful dreams that overwhelmed them, and they were disturbed by them, troubled by them. Verse 9, Joseph gives God's interpretation of the dreams to each of them. The chief butler in verse 12 is going to be restored to his position of honor after 3 days, according to his dream. Verse 14, it says, verse 12, the chief butler. Yeah, that's right. He's going to be brought back to his position of honor. Verse 14, let's do read this. Joseph has a glimmer of hope here. But remember me, he says to the chief butler, when it is well with you. Please show kindness to me. Make mention of me to Pharaoh and get me out of this house, out of this prison. For indeed I was stolen away from the land of the Hebrews, and also I have done nothing here that they should put me into this dungeon. Verse 16 tells of the interpretation of the chief baker. And he was not going to be so fortunate. When the chief baker sees the interpretation was good, he says to Joseph, I also said in this dream, and he tells about his dream. Verse 19, within 3 days, Joseph says, here's the interpretation. Pharaoh's going to lift off your head and hang it on a tree. The birds will eat your flesh from you. Not a good interpretation for the chief baker. Jump down to verse 21. Then Pharaoh, restores the chief butler to his butlership. He places the cup back in Pharaoh's hand. This is a designation of the highest position of trust next to the king himself. To taste test his food, drink from his cup. Yes, nobody's poisoned your wine. Here you go, king. If I drop dead, then don't drink it, okay? It's that simple. But I mean, there's more to it than he handed him his cup. It means it's emblematic of a lot of trust. And so what's it say? Pharaoh restores chief butler. Verse 22, he hanged the chief baker as Joseph interpreted. Verse 23, the chief butler did not remember Joseph, but forgot him. Joseph's expectations are high. Days turn into weeks, turn into months. Joseph waits and waits in that prison. His only hope, physically speaking, was that the chief butler would mention his name to Pharaoh and get him out of the dungeon. Says he was forgotten. The story's not over. 2 more years. It does literally say 2 more years Joseph remained a prisoner. And to add to this disappointment, this pain of ingratitude for encouraging the chief butler, Now a divine hand is just about to open the door in an amazing way for Joseph, Genesis 41, verse 1. Then it came to pass, at the end of 2 full years, Pharaoh had a dream. Behold, he stood by the river. I won't tell you the dream, but Pharaoh has this agonizing, troubling dream about the fat, healthy cows, the skinny cows. It comes to interpret that there are going to be 7 years of plentiful harvests in all of Egypt, followed by 7 years of famine. Start right away storing up stores for the 7 bad years. Verse 16 of verse 41, Joseph answers Pharaoh, saying, "It's not in me. God will give Pharaoh the answer of peace, the answer to his troubling dream." And then, of course, we go down to verse 37. Joseph gives advice on what to do. God gives him the wisdom to give this advice after he's taken out of the prison, cleaned up, and presented before Pharaoh. Verse 37, "So the advice was good in the eyes of Pharaoh and in the eyes of all his servants. And Pharaoh says to his servants, 'Can we find such a one as this, in whom is the Spirit of God?'" What does that convey, except that here again is one of these powerful examples where one of God's faithful leaders, so we say servants, is thrust into a pagan land that doesn't believe in the one true God of Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob. And the influence is very powerful, and it lasts a long time. This is exactly what happens when this Pharaoh starts giving a lot of responsibility to Joseph. Verse 39, Pharaoh says to Joseph, "Inasmuch as God has shown you this, all this, there's no one as discerning and as wise as you are. You shall be over my house, and all my people shall be ruled according to your word. Only in regard to the throne will I be greater than you." And Pharaoh said to Joseph, "See, I've set you over all the land of Egypt." Can we see how God can turn things around and do stunning wonders in even our personal lives? Now, not all of us, not probably any of us in this room, are going to be in this physical life a ruler of a great nation, which was the most powerful nation on earth at that time. But what about the life to come? What about the spirit realm? What about when Christ returns? Well, yes, indeed, this affects us in a big way. Yes, indeed, in a big way. Skip down to verse 46. It finishes the narrative of today's story. Joseph was 30 years old when he stood before Pharaoh, king of Egypt. And Joseph went out from the presence of Pharaoh and went throughout all the land of Egypt. Of course, we know what his main responsibility included: governing the harvests, the storage, building silos, preparing the nation for 7 years of famine, but that would greatly enhance the wealth. Money would come pouring in to Egypt. And then, of course, we know that this is another stepping stone for Jacob and the other brothers and the rest of the family, the 70, that would come down from Canaan into Egypt. Throughout Joseph's life, he was a stranger in a heathen land from age 17 on. He would be subject to temptations like you and me, separated from his family, again, maybe never seeing his mother Rachel again. He was separated from the other worshipers of God, but it was through his constant reliance on what he had been taught that he faithfully carried out his duties in whatever place and position he was found in. I hope to bring to you part 2 of the story of Joseph. Today was mainly about leadership. In my conclusion, I asked the question, how was Joseph enabled to rise to such astonishing authority without even it corrupting him? If he's second to Pharaoh in the most powerful land in the world at that time, with all the regalia, all the temptations that Egypt had to offer, and we know that from when Moses was told that he refused all the temptations of Egypt some decades later, or hundreds of years later, actually. Well, the answer is for Joseph, 13 years of testing. would pass to prepare him for this governorship. Today's message hopefully illustrated two simple things. One, forming a noble character takes time and diligent perseverance and preparation. Forming character takes time, and that's how people are prepared for sudden trials and sudden temptations. They've been preparing in advance. And two, a second lesson today would be that God's people must at times endure hardship and trial to be able to bear more fruit, knowing that all things work together for good for those who love God and who are called according to his purpose. Romans 8, verse 28. Joseph's character was refined and tested through adversity, humiliation, false accusation, having to patiently wait on God to steer him through those events. We too are promised that eventually we're going to be elevated from this temporary physical existence and made co-rulers with Jesus Christ, if we too endure to the end and hold fast our crown. Joseph would live 110 years, indicating that from age 30 to 110, it was about 80 years, that he could have continued a strong influence over Egypt after being restored from his prison. That is the short story of Joseph's test and Joseph's triumph.